So, fourth canto, first chapter, genealogical table of the daughter of Manu, text number 7. Tusa pratusa santosho. That's on the board? No. Okay. Bhadra shantiri daspati itmakavir vibhushvana sudevo ruchano disha. Tosha, Pratosha, Pratosha, Santosha, Santosha, Bhadra, Bhadra, Shanti, Shanti, Idaspati, Idaspati, Idma, Idma, Kavi, Kavi, Vibhu, Vibhu, Swana, guess what? Swana, Sudeva, Sudeva, very good, Rochana, Rochana, Dvisa, 12. Translation. The 12 boys born of Yajna and Dakshina were named Tosha, Pratosh, and Santosh, Bhadra, Shanti, Idaspati, Itma, Kavi, Vibhu, Swana, Sudeva, and Rochana. The next verse, number 8. Tusita namate deva asan svayambhuvantari marichi misra risayo yajna sura ganeshwara. Translation. During the time of Swayambhuva Manu, these sons all became the demigods collectively named the Tusitas. Marichi became the head of the seven rishis, and Yajna became the king of the demigods, Indra. Purport. During the life of Swayambhuva Manu, six kinds of living entities were generated from the demigods, known as the Tusitas, from the sages headed by Marichi, and from descendants of Yajna, king of the demigods, and all of them expended their progeny to observe the order of the Lord to fill the universe with living entities. These six kinds of living entities are known as Manus, Devas, Manuputras, Amsa Avatar, Sureshwaras, and Rishis. Yajna became the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yajna, being the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, became the leader of the demigods, Indra. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Ginandana Salakya Chakshura Militam Yanatas Mai Shri Gurave Namaha. So there are innumerable demigods, and they're not all of equal power. Some demigods are known as the principal demigods, such as Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Vayu, Agni, Varuna, and so on. And it is said there are 33 principal demigods, and then there are, and each of them has 1 crore of assistants. A crore is known to be 10 million. Sometimes we hear there are 33 million demigods, sometimes we hear there are 33 crores of demigods. Over the zero, there is sometimes some different information. What can we say? It doesn't make so much difference, actually. Whatever may be, there are many demigods who are assisting. We're in an assisting role. So here we are also seeing a description of such demigods. In traditional times, there has been a lot of worship of such demigods. We're seeing that even nowadays there's a community named Findhorn. It is in the north of Scotland, right? And they are actually worshipping these secondary demigods. And they had remarkable results, because up north there in Scotland, the climate is quite rough. So flowers and things are not so easily growing. But in Findhorn, flowers and all kinds of things grow even out of season. When nobody has any, they have. by their worship of the smaller devas. So all the fairy tales of little elves, etc., are not just all to be written off. These things are certainly there. These are indeed the secondary demigods that are controlling various aspects of material nature. However, in pagan religions, they were trying to pacify such entities and make offerings to them. In Krishna consciousness, this is not required. Although we certainly are recognizing that there are personalities behind every function in the universe, that the modern idea that of a big mechanistic model of the universe, a machine, it's all a machine and it's just all rotating by magnetic fields, etc. Totally bogus. An absolutely useless idea. Rather, everything is controlled by personalities, just as we are personalities and we control so many things. So many things are under our power going on. Mankind is nicely controlling electricity, nice, and we are using it in so many ways. So many forces we manage to control. So within the realm of our existence, there is a certain control, and within the realm of the existence of the demigods, there is a certain level of control. So all the entire universe is controlled by personalities. That is the point. Everything is going on under the guidance of personalities. Therefore, instead of a very impersonal arrangement, everything is a very personal arrangement. That is the fact. And we see that in Srimad Bhagavatam, also the way that it is described that Lord Brahma is appearing is very personal. Here is the Supreme Personality of Godhead is creating universes from his own body. Right? It's all coming out of his own body. It's not just he creates them by some sort of mental energy and plop, 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 plop. There were all the universes, but it's very physical. That's right, coming right from his own body. I mean, it is physically also very connected to it, very personal and physically connected to it. And then the Lord expands himself and enters into that universe, and again, in a very intimate physical way, the perspiration from his own body fills up half of that universe with water. And then he lies down on that water, and then again, from his navel, from his very navel comes then some extension, and there, the navel is like a flower, and then that stem extends, and there is a lotus flower. And Lord Brahma is on top of there. So it's kind of very personal, and it's quite, it may be bewildering to the mind of modern men, but he forgets that we ourselves also appear in a very personal way, connected to a string with the navel and so on. Right? So in that sense, it's not so awkward, actually, if we're looking at what's taking place with us. It's in the same type of arrangement. So everything is very personal and not at all impersonal. Therefore, within the impersonal arrangements of modern society, we're suffocating. We're feeling a great vacuum. We're feeling empty. And then people become lonely. People become estranged. People feel no longer connection with themselves. They start looking for their roots and so on. And psychology becomes like a big issue because we have lost contact with our true nature. So Krishna consciousness is reconnecting us with our true nature, because one can not know, anything in this world if it is not seen in connection with the Supreme Lord. Srimad Bhagavatam is describing 10 subject matters. Right? It's known as the Mahapurana, Atra Sargas, Visargas Cha. It begins to describe the primary creation, the secondary creation, Atra Sargas, Visargas Cha. Then the second line, where does it start? Just the third verse. No, Nirodha is the last. Nirodha Muktir Asraya is the last one. Manvantara is the third, but the second, first word of the second line. Atra Sargas Visargas Cha Stanam Poshanam Uttiya Manvantara Shitsana Kata. Okay, now we have them all. So it is said it is describing first creation by Lord Vishnu, secondary creation by Lord Brahma, maintenance of the universe, support and protection of the living entities, the creative principle which is there. It describes destruction, it describes the manus, it describes all these various things. It describes the if we summarize it, because I know the way I was just presenting it wasn't like very coherent. So if I present it in a little more summarized form, then all these various aspects kind of cover many, many aspects of the cosmic manifestation of what exists. It is displaying how things come into being. It is describing how it is maintained, how the living beings are part in it all, etc. So in these 10 subject matters, basically, or in these 9 subject matters, I should say, in 9 subject matters, basically the entire situation of the living being in his environment is described. And then it said there are 10 subject matters in Bhagavatam, and 9 are asrita, shelter seeking. Right? And 1 is asraya, shelter given, and that is Krishna. So in this way, everything depends on asraya. Everything depends on the shelter. And we also depend on shelter. We again and again need shelter. If we don't get shelter, there's no question. There's no question of survival or functioning. We need shelter in so many ways. So we are always shelter seeking. So all are shelter seeking and depending upon Asraya. So this is the situation. Although there may be so many demigods, although there may be so many energies, everything depends on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everything depends on One. And that is Krishna consciousness. So Krishna consciousness is not polytheism or the kind of religious concept where there are many gods that are worshipped. No, Krishna consciousness is simply accepting One, One Personality. And that is essential. Nitya nityanam chetanas chetananam ekubhanam yavidadati kamam. There are many eternals, and of all these eternal beings, there is one upon whom all others depend, the Supreme Lord. And this is the point, that ultimately we need shelter. And we look for shelter in so many things. But Srimad Bhagavatam is pointing out that all the shelter we're looking for may not necessarily be able to give us shelter. Like someone looks for shelter in family. But it said, Atmasanyesu asitsu api, that actually this family is simply, they are simply fallible soldiers. They offer protection, but they can also not offer protection. They need protection themselves. They need as much protection as anybody else. That is the fact. So fallible soldiers. So why turn to fallible soldiers? Only Krishna can really protect, and only Krishna is the shelter. So this is the very essence that we must turn to Krishna for shelter. It's all good and well to go through a very analytical study of material nature, and to see how this material nature is connected with the Supreme Lord. That is a very nice exercise, because that exercise is increasing our faith. We are in the Bhagavatam getting, and in other scriptures, getting a lengthy description of how the material energy is connected with the Supreme Lord in various ways. How actually he's behind it all, how actually it is his energy, how actually it's his arrangement, how actually it's his plan. So although we don't see him, but still Bhagavatam is again and again illustrating that in different ways. But for what purpose? To bring us to the next step. And the next step is, okay, so Krishna is the only shelter. So Krishna is all that matters. So devotional service to Krishna is the only thing to do. Right? That's what it's leading up to. The whole purpose. Therefore, sometimes when we are making a great issue of tattva, there are some who are really stressing the importance of tattva. Right? It's all about tattva. So what is this tattva? Tattva means philosophical truth. Tattva. So there are many different aspects of tattva. Many aspects of the absolute truth. Because Krishna is manifest in many aspects. So by knowing all the aspects, by knowing the true nature of all the aspects of Krishna, one knows the different tattvas of Krishna, how Krishna, there's jiva tattva. It is the true nature of the living being, right? Okay, it is Krishna's separated part and parcel. That is what it means, right? There is, there are many tattvas. Let us say there is, what? Yeah, you can. If you want me to say Shakti tattva, I was thinking of Varnashram tattva myself. Many tattvas, many aspects. And each of them we can see their nature. And that's important. We must be strong in our understanding of the nature of Krishna. If we don't understand how Krishna is God or the Supreme Lord, then how will we ever be able to appreciate Krishna? But yet, we see in Srimad Bhagavatam that the topmost devotees, the gopis, right, were not spending their day with tattva. Yeah. They were not. They were not sitting there all day turning over tattva left and right and a little more deeper philosophical discussion about the intricate nature of the shaktis and the energies of Krishna emanating from him and exactly how it all works. Right? How does it all work? How does the creation really work? As the gopi says, yeah, the creation. Yeah, comes from the Supreme Lord. Yes. And they were not so concerned, because they had already gone to the stage of accepting, yes, Krishna is the Supreme Lord and service to him is what it's all about. In fact, they'd gone beyond that. They even forgot that Krishna was the Supreme Lord but Krishna was the most important person in their life. So this illustrates the point that to simply study philosophy for philosophy's sake is not our business. We are philosophical, but we are not philosophers. Right? We are not philosophers. Philosophers spend their whole day philosophizing, and their taste is variety of philosophy, a new flavor of philosophy, a new idea. Right? There is a light in the eye of the philosopher who has just come up with another angle. Imagine if, but this is not our business. Our business is to be philosophical, but not philosophers, in the sense that we are understanding how Krishna is the ultimate cause. It is said there is an immediate cause and there is a remote cause of everything. Like when someone comes up to us and mistreats us, we can of course hold those persons responsible. We can develop a grudge. We can become upset. But then again, we can be more transcendental, and we can see that behind this is also Krishna, and he's the ultimate cause. Therefore, Krishna is more important. Yeah? Krishna was also allowing this to happen. Right? He allowed this. So ultimately, Krishna did it. Yeah? Ultimately, Krishna was behind it. If Krishna rake marake, Krishna mara rakake. If Krishna wants to kill, who can save? If Krishna wants to save, who can kill? So therefore, Krishna also let it happen. For us, the main issue is not, why did this conditioned soul mistreat me? Obvious, it's understood, because he is, he's mentally cut up, right? Because he's like contaminated by the material energy. But that's not a question there. How could he do this? Obviously, he's under the modes, right? How could he do this? That's what living energies do under the modes. So why ask this question? How could he do such a thing? Obviously, he can do such a thing because he's under the modes. But the real question is, why did the Supreme Lord ultimately do this? Not a blade of grass moves without his will. And what have I done to deserve this, possibly? Those are the real deeper questions. And those are the questions of a devotee. Those are the questions that are purifying. Those are the questions where one can take whatever happens in his life and use it for one's spiritual betterment, no matter what it is. Krishna is sometimes making someone very prominent. And sometimes Krishna is making someone very insignificant. Right? In spite of two people may have equal qualification, but one is made prominent and the other one is made insignificant. Why? Why? These questions we should ask, right? When we are experiencing that we are being minimized, when our prominence is being minimized. So many times we will experience that we will come up, we will come up, we will come up, and we will become prominent. And then, reduced. Right? So when we are reduced, then we can consider this. Why? If we're not asking why, and if we don't take it upon ourselves, okay, back in the cycle. Back in the cycle of the material energy, and again we can come up, and again we can come down, because yad brahmatam talabhyate upariyada, that is the nature of the of material life. Upwards and downwards, coming up and going down, that is our position. But if we see that the very purpose of everything that is happening to me now is to make me turn to the Supreme Lord and to make me acknowledge my dependence upon the Supreme Lord. Yes. To make me accept that I'm totally dependent on the Supreme Lord. It is said, saptake purusam nisu, it is explained that the ability, I'm the sound in ether, I'm the ability in man. Right. Yes. So, the ability in man is given to us and is taken away. Right. Krishna, yasyaham anugrinami taddanam harije sanai. The Lord gives and the Lord takes as he likes. But all along, the very purpose behind that is to make us turn to him and to make us just realize that whatever we have is his property, is his gift, placed under our care to be used for his purposes. In the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the Kshetrajna, the knower of the field, the living entity within the body is like situated on a field, is situated on the field of the body. And it is said he is the knower of the field, Kshetrajna. Kshetra is field and Gya means knower. He's the knower of the field, the living being. Yes, we know this field. Through this field, we know. Through this body. So we do everything through there. We're the knower of this body. We're getting constant information. Right? It is constantly some signal coming up from somewhere, whatever is going on in this field. Yes, okay, yes, all right. Head cold, all right, put something on there, and so on. Thousands of signals coming from the body, constantly being registered. We are the knower of the field. But there is another knower of the field, which is the Supreme Lord. So, what is the relationship of these two knowers of the field? It is that the Supreme Lord is the proprietor, and the living entity is the caretaker. He's simply the cultivator. There's cultivator and proprietor. So if one is proprietor of the field, then one may not work on the field. But the cultivator is working on the field. But the produce of the field is not his. It belongs to the owner. That is the point. So this is our position. And this is a big fundamental change for us because we grew up in a Western culture which basically was based on Christian ideology. And one of the fundamental misconceptions in Christian ideology is that this whole world has been created for us to enjoy. Yes? So, you know, God gave us dominion over all that be, and now just be happy. It doesn't. And then, okay, we're all trying that now for thousands of years, right? We've tried. Yes, he gave us that. All this is all for us to enjoy. Enjoy it, enjoy it. I'm trying. We're trying, but it is difficult. It doesn't work so well. It works a bit, but not all the way. That's the nature of material energy. Because once we come in contact with Krishna consciousness, we understand it's not at all meant for us to enjoy. It is meant for the Lord to enjoy, and we are the caretakers, the cultivators on his behalf, and everything under our care is for him. And he gives us, and he takes away. And we accept, simply, humbly, we are his servants. And when an advanced devotee, once I saw in Vrindavan, there was one devotee. He was the Sankirtan leader, and he was like older devotee, and he was like sitting in Vrindavan in the book goda, the stores of the book. And then he had all the Sankirtan devotees coming to him. And then he was an older devotee, so they were all offering him respects. And instead of his Vyasa-san, he had the seat an old seat out of a Sankirtan bus, you know. So it looked really like Sankirtan, Sankirtan Acharya sitting on his Sankirtan Vyasa-san, you know. And then he was like lecturing to the Sankirtan devotees and motivating them. So a kind of a service which was more than just being, looking after Sankirtan, but also many devotees who spiritually depended on him, and he was able to inspire them. So it's satisfying if you can actually inspire people, because you get some inspiration from that. You definitely feel I'm good for something, you know. It gives some satisfaction if you do something, if you uplift others, you start to feel like, well, I have some, my existence has some use at least, you know. I'm not just totally a useless misfit whose life has no meaning. My life has some meaning. A lot of people are looking for meaning in life, right? A mother means something to the child, right? Like just the child depends on her, and it's just like that gives meaning to her life, you know, that this child needs her. If nobody needs me, then it becomes very depressing. If nobody needs you, then, you know, God, suicide comes close when nobody needs you. Yeah. This is a thing. Nobody needs me. So that was is a kind of a service if one looks after others, where one naturally may have some attachment. You know. But then we asked him to do another service, and it was necessary. There was no one else to do it. And he said, okay, I'll do it. And he did it, and he never looked back at the old service. And he's immediately full-on got into the new service. So I could understand from that, he's attached to Krishna. He's not attached to a particular type of service. And he's not attached to a particular position. He's not attached to, I'm doing this and I like to do this. And he's not attached to a particular type of activity. He's attached to Krishna, to serving Krishna. From that I could understand. Advanced. Great soul. Well, that's a fact. We must be attached to Krishna. Yes. We're also attached, we're attached to devotional service. We're never going to stop devotional service. No way, right? I mean, what can we do? You know, if they, we're not going to stop it. If they throw us out because they finally have decided in a meeting that we are too obnoxious and they throw us out the front door, well, okay, what are we going to do? You know, still some service, right? Maybe stand in the road. Point people. Here's the Hare Krishna temple. It's nice, but or clean the sidewalk in front of the temple. If they don't let us in, go back in the markets, get some vegetables, and put the boxes in front of the door. Ring the doorbell, put a box of vegetables across in front of the door. We're not going to stop. We can't stop, even if they don't let us. We'll still do. What to do? We have to. We are attached to devotional service, but whatever that devotional service may be, that's up to Krishna and his representatives. That is not in our hands. Such is the nature of spiritual life, of humble Vaishnava who is attached to Krishna, and that's Bhagavatam. If we are going through this whole description during the time of Swayambhuva Manu, so it's always very mystical when you speak about Manus, you know. It's like, what are Manus? Right? What do Manus look like? Are Manus human beings? Or do Manus have wings, you know? How big are Manus? Are they big or are they small? Do they have subtle bodies? Do Manus have gross bodies, right, like us? Are Manus living on this planet? Or is there a planet called Manuloka, right? Which planet do they live, if it's in this material world? Huh? Okay. So, we are understanding that Swayambhuva Manu is the mental son of Lord Brahma. We understand that he has a human form, right? And yet we understand that he's the forefather of mankind, and that Swayambhuva Manu was the first to engage in procreation. Because we heard that prior to Swayambhuva Manu, the other sons of Lord Brahma were mental creations who were like very powerful mystic sages who had the order of their father to populate the universe and, yeah, basically could do that through mystic power. But they were not motivated. So the universe didn't populate very well, it is said. But then, along with Swayambhuva Manu, there what was the name? Sutapa or something? No, what's the wife's name? Satarupa, exactly. Satarupa. Satarupa. So Swayambhuva Manu's wife, Satarupa, was actually the first created woman. Right? So there's some sort of Adam and Eve story appearing here. The original couple, right, from whom mankind then evolved. Because it said once these two elements, male and female, were there, then procreation was moving along very well. And the universe populated. So in this way, Swayambhuva Manu. But we see some of his sons are becoming demigods, right? So Swayambhuva Manu is obviously now in the time of Swayambhuva Manu, it wasn't so separated. Now, like being demigods, right? It's not possible. Like Prabhupada wrote his book Easy Journey to Other Planets, and basically it's very clear that if you want to go to another planet, you have to go by changing body, right? Because we don't have a body which is suitable for the other planet. Right? So what can we do there? Walk around with this body on that in that other atmosphere. Right? But in the times of the Bhagavatam, so in previous yugas, there was interplanetary travel was possible. We see that kings from this earth were just traveling to higher planetary systems, and they could do so in this body without any difficulties and function there and so on. So if someone gets into the nitpicking questions of, but how is that possible? I mean, isn't it that they have other types of bodies over there more subtle than here? And how can someone even see those more subtle bodies? Then all we can say, yes, they could. Right? And say, well, but these are very interesting questions. No, these are not very interesting questions. These kind of questions are actually missing the point. They're missing the point. So there are many questions that miss the point, because the point is simply Krishna and devotional service to Krishna. And how is it connected to Krishna? How does it come from Krishna? And we're just looking Krishna. And how can we serve Krishna? And how can this understanding help me to serve Krishna better? Because that's Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is not the ultimate Vedic encyclopedia. Although Srimad Bhagavatam is the natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, which means Vedanta is the end of all Vedic knowledge, yet it is not like the ultimate Vedic encyclopedia, which gives us the ultimate answer to every ultimate possible question that you could come up with in your brain. It doesn't. It leaves many things vague. Yeah. Many details are not given. But it gives all the necessary details to see how everything is connected with Krishna. Because what is Bhagavatam telling us? Everything is connected with Krishna. And everything has the purpose of being used in the service of Krishna, including us. Huh? So the human body is meant to be used in the service of Krishna. How? That depends. According to our nature. It's not so rigorous. Surrender, surrender, or rot. Right? Fuck. Surrender to Krishna, bow down, or just burn in the material world, and there's no alternative. It's not that bad. No. There is a lot of room for somehow or other engaging in the service of Krishna. But the whole purpose of a verse like this, of understanding the two sitas, you know. It's not that, I mean, with all due respect to the two sitas, right? We don't care that much about understanding very much about the two sitas, right? It's not that, like, now today, dear devotees, we've come to a very important part of the Bhagavatam. So be attentive. We have, now today, we've come to describing the Tusitas. Wake up! You know, this is your chance to understand everything about the Tusitas, right? So it's like, you know, Tusitas. To tell you the truth, I forgot all about the Tusitas. It's just that we're reading about the Tusitas today, but if somebody would have asked me before reading this verse, who are the Tusitas, I would go, Tusitas. Would not have remembered. Because it's not so essential to know these two sitas per se, but to know that they were the sons of Lord Yajna, who was the empowered incarnation of the Lord, who appeared in this universe to establish religious principles, and that they were assisting him in this way. That is important. So that we understand that there is a plan in the universe. In, like, people don't know. Extraterrestrials, science fiction books. If you read a science fiction books, then sometimes there are stories that bring out one point. And the point is that whatever you can think of must exist somewhere in the universe. Come across that. If you can think of a, and they give the example, if you can think of a purple man with a wart and three hairs and all these things, and long nails and fangs, etc., he must exist somewhere, because, you know, it's part of the reality that you can think of, and the collective total of everything we can think of means that's all part of reality. Very deep, right? I think it's very deep. So there is all this insecurity about what's out there. Anything can be out there. Anything can come out of space any moment. Right? We hope it's not, but it could happen. Anything. And you just don't know when the doors open, if there are even going to be doors, to this space shuttle, and God knows what comes out. Anything can come out. Anxiety. So, but with Bhagavatam, that's all over now. That's all over now. Because we begin to understand the purpose of the universe. We begin to understand the order of the universe. We begin to understand the arrangement of the universe. So we understand some general principles. And they're all there to bring everyone to that point where he just says Krishna, Krishna, and Krishna. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu began to explain Sanskrit grammar while he was in the mood of a devotee, he explained every word, every single Sanskrit word, systematically explained how it meant Krishna. Every word meant Krishna. Everything. No matter what. He gave, like, he went to the root of a word, Krishna. It means Krishna. So he had been teaching like that for weeks, and deeply absorbed. So one day I asked his students, is my teaching all right? He said, yes, it is all right. We cannot find any fault with it, because it's technically, it's perfectly all right. But you have already for 2 weeks just explained that every word just means Krishna. This is a fact, you know. It all just means Krishna. And that's what it's all about. And therefore, the answer to any question is actually Krishna. So, are there any questions? Sure. No, there is an element. If you don't surrender, you're gonna suffer. Surrender or suffer. It's a fact. But it's in the context in which I spoke it. It doesn't mean that there's only one thing you can do and nothing else, right? Still, the context of Krishna consciousness is very broad. Right? Even within devotional service, we are given room to do different services. Right? But one service is the highest, to just do whatever your spiritual master asks, right? Whether you like it or not, and just take it like your heart and soul. That is the highest. But sometimes people can't do that. They still don't become sinful. They still stay within the realm of regulative principles and 16 rounds, but they're not exactly following spiritual master. Now, what is their destiny? Is it hell? No, it's not hell. Yeah? It's not that they go to hell. It's just that they don't get the full taste. They still don't get the full taste, and they are not on the path of going back to Godhead this lifetime. The path of going back to God, it is just to hold, is narrow. Is to, there's no alter, it's only surrender very strictly, in a, fully. That, at least trying that, and then hoping that whatever falls short is made up. So, but it is a movement which, within the process of Krishna consciousness, gives a lot of room to people. Right? And that is I want to say that, you know, to kind of stress that it's not so rigorous, you know. Sometimes it looks so rigid, Krishna consciousness, you know, like celibacy. This morning I opened up a conversation book and it was all about deprogramming, about Ted Patrick, right? Ted Patrick was the famous American deprogrammer. And there was an interesting thing that Adhikesha was a sannyasi at the time. And he was with Ted Patrick in a TV program. And he said in a TV program, he asked Ted Patrick if he would deprogram the Pope if he had the chance, right? And Ted Patrick had said, definitely. Ted Patrick, before actually I should take it one step back in the conversation, there had been a discussion that Ted Patrick had said that anyone who is just committing himself to celibacy, right, should be deprogrammed. And then the question was, so the Pope, would you deprogram the Pope? And he said, definitely. So I thought it was pretty good. So here we are with this celibacy, right? And, you know, I mean, is this real? That was Ted Patrick's point. Come on, you know, be real, man. This is not real, right? I mean, this is not what we are, you know? Why don't you just, like, live an honest life and just be what you are instead of going to some artificial thing where you deny yourself? Why, for the sake of your religion, do you have to deny yourself? He is asking that question. And now I'm asking it to you. Can anyone reply? Why, for the sake of religion, are you denying your true nature? Why are you doing this to yourself? Radha Vallabha.
We are denying ourselves for so many things. Even if you're not religious, you're denying yourself for your boss. Now why go to your work? Why regulate your eating? Why not eat wherever you want?
Okay.
If you really don't want to deny, why just jump on any thing you're sexually attracted to and have sex?
Well, I mean, you know, okay, you can't have everything that you want, right? And there are many restrictions. But there are degrees of restriction. No one is restricting himself to the extreme, you know. It's like, you know, why torture yourself? You may have to work for some boss because you have to make money, but you're not gonna choose a type of work where you are suffering and suffering and suffering. Then you change your job and you try to within, young man, find some kind of job where you get some satisfaction, and at the same time you have to make the sacrifice, right, to get the money. You have to make some compromise in life. So if we take this now back to celibacy, you say it's so extreme. And then when I ask you the question, then you respond by saying something rude, like jumping on anything that moves in the street, etc. So do you think that's an appropriate answer? Why do you see life so black and white? Why is it only extremes? Why are you either looking at celibacy on the one hand or raping people on the other? Isn't there something like affection that is just expressed through normal human relationships? Right? Is there no room for that? Then, what's wrong with sex?
The difference between sex and affection or intimacy,
what's the difference? It's a means to it's between two people that love each other. It's a way to express that affection. What's wrong with that?
Generally, it's not for expressing their affection. It's out of somebody's own lust.
Yeah, but like, you know, there are people who are deeply caring for each other, who are sacrificing their whole life for each other, right? And you can so easily write off everything as lust, right? And try and bring it down to a gross, bestial platform. But we're seeing that people give their sacrifice their whole life for someone else. So how can you just write that off as gross, bestial love, lust, you know, and say there's no love?
There are different ways also. It's not like we're talking black and white. It's also not black and white, as you said.
Now you get into semantics. Now you're no longer giving substance. Now you're just going semantics. Okay, someone else.
Well, actually, we are not denying ourselves, but we do the best that we can for ourselves. Because actually, we are not denying ourselves, but our false material nature, but it's not our real nature. So therefore, to know if we deny ourselves or not, we have to know who we are.
Can you explain it a little more elaborate?
I don't think so. So, to know if we deny ourselves, we have to know who we are and what is our real nature. So till now, it seems that we deny our real nature, we deny our pushing of the senses and the sense enjoyment. But if we come to the point where we see that this is not our real nature, and if we see what is our real identity, then it makes sense to see how we will really be come to the point where what is to deny and what not.
Nice. Is there anybody dissatisfied with these answers of these two gentlemen? Well, I'm just asking first if there's anyone who's... Does everyone buy into what they say, or is there someone who's saying, well, you know, I don't agree. I'm trying to create a political rift here. Divide the audience. You don't agree with what he says?
No, because it seems that he wants to turn to the not the body thing. Our real position is we're soul, not the body. So if you're not the body...
I see, he's just turned into a agnostic. he's turned into the devil's advocate. Okay. He wants an answer, yeah, sure.
Okay, I don't know, maybe it would take a little too long.
No, you can smash him, no problem.
Okay.
Don't let him give an answer. Hey, he's going to give an answer, so shut up, Radhavallam.
Okay. So the point is, if we know now that we are the spirit soul, but still we have some condition. We still have the body. And that we have to deal with it. And so we have to see what things in this material universe world we can use that will help us to come to really realize that we are souls, and what things we should not use because it will just not help us to come to the point to realize we are souls. So therefore we take the things that will develop our consciousness, that will help us to come to a higher point, and therefore we also have the things out of the Vedic culture that are made in the mode of goodness, and therefore try to keep away from that things that will drag us down to the most passionate things.
Yeah.
And there are also little things like the address.
Now his answer is correct and good, you know, it's solid. Your objections were simply taking a position of a person who is badly informed, right? Who doesn't know that
prasadam is prasadam, and then so you're just looking at spiritual activity but from a mundane perspective. So your objection was only external, but not dealing with the substance of his point. The substance of his point is simply that if we are we have two aspects to our nature, a lower material nature and a spiritual nature, and if we engage in activities that relate to our lower nature, they will further cover our true nature. And by denying the activities of the lower nature and cultivating the activities of the higher nature, gradually lower nature decreases and the higher nature increases. So he's philosophically correct. Whether, you know, I mean, whether his language is the best, he speaks English, in which is not his first language, and so on. It's like, that's another matter. You know, the presentation, you can make it a PowerPoint presentation with computer graphics and make it really impressive, etc. But the substance is totally correct. But my question was going a little, was going to the root of something where you say that, well, everyone has sex desire in this world, right? So how many people are there in our movement who are free from sex desire? So therefore, we are not really dealing with Ted Patrick. Actually, we're dealing with our mind on this question. So it is a deep, fundamental question. Ted Patrick is only the personification of a little aspect in our mind. And why actually celibacy? And why would we embrace it? And are we really free from the desire of hankering for any type of physical affection? Yeah. These are like deeper questions, you see. They're not just exercises in philosophical debate, but they go right deep into our own psychology, into our, these are issues for us. Yeah. So that's why I'm asking this question. Why would we... So it looks like it's a very heavy movement. It looks like very rigid to be celibate. Looks like, you know, like I immediately thought that when the Hare Krishna movement was there, as soon as I heard celibate, I didn't come too close. I mean, you know, I kept my distance from the Hare Krishna movement for quite a while because I thought it's too much. You know, it's just too much. And then, okay, there's a whole recruiting thing, you know, as soon as you come near, let go of this, give it back, right? So, you know, I definitely kept a secure distance. But first of all, because of the heavy discipline. So the higher tastes principle is very important. And within that, I also wanted to say that it's not all based on restriction. It's all not based on sense control. It's not all based on no, no, no. No illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, no meat. You can't eat anywhere, no fish, no eggs. It's not just all no in all directions. I'm Hare Krishna, and wherever I look, I always see two letters, you know. And no entry, not allowed, no, right? Can I eat this? No. Can I? No. I can't do anything, right? But it's not just all no. So there's a lot of positive experience in Krishna consciousness and a lot of room for expressing one's own nature. And that's why to just go into like a contrast of surrender or burn kind of thing, it is nice to discuss a little bit of great in between. We say, like, you can play piano for Krishna. Why not? Right? You can make beautiful melodies. You go very deep away in that. It's nice. Why not? You can paint. You can sing. You can, You can dance. You can do many things for Krishna. According to our nature, you can make write computer programs for the Lord. It's all possible. So we can express our personality. And that is very important. Right. And in the past, we didn't understand that sufficiently, and we became too much into the no consciousness. Not this, not this, not this, and not this, and then this is Krishna consciousness. Right. Very narrow and small. Okay, any other questions? Krishna. 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 Now, with all due respect to you, Prabhupada commented, it could happen. It's not relevant. It's Krishna. So it's not that it's impossible, but there's no relevance to anything. I mean, you'd have to find a context where that would be relevant in service to Krishna, because there's no such thing as that gopas and gopis are just engaged in, and well, okay, what are we going to do now? You know, we don't really have so much service at the moment, so what shall we do? Let's think of something, you know. Let's go for a bicycle ride or something like that. You know, it's like every moment is totally intensely connected in service to Krishna. Yeah. So generally it doesn't have any relevance. Service to Krishna. So only if there would be an exceptional circumstance where such a thing would have relevance in service to Krishna, it would become possible. So it's not impossible, but generally it has no relevance in the service of Krishna. He doesn't require that. You see? So the gopas and gopis are only thinking of what Krishna requires. They're not only engaging in Krishna's service, but their whole being is just thinking about what Krishna requires and how can we give him that? And they're making plans about that. So they don't think about anything else. So they don't think, God. The gopa doesn't think, wow, this gopi looks really good. If he does, he thinks Krishna will be very happy. Just things about Krishna.
I just heard your last question, why don't we indulge in sex life? I don't know if what I say is relevant. I remember a remark of Dr. Vikas Maharaj. He says the main reason why we don't do certain things is because Krishna wants it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says if Krishna would have asked us to eat meat, or if we would eat meat.
Prabhupada said like that. There's a tape, you know, where Prabhupada says that if Krishna would have told us to offer him flesh, we would kill all the animals. He said in such a heavy way, you know. All the animals must have held their breath in the whole universe. And he said. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's the bottom line. But Krishna is not just whimsically asking sacrifices that we have to make for his, just to satisfy him. So we're doing it for Krishna, but it's not just that Krishna is whimsically asking. Krishna has purposes, and we can also understand Krishna's purpose within. So there's also a why. You know, it is Krishna. So ultimately we're doing it for Krishna. But it's not just well, just because Krishna wants it, we got to do it. No, there's also Krishna wants it because otherwise, and then his explanation, you know. Otherwise, we get entangled in the lower nature and we become covered over and, you know, jayato visyapumsa, you know, dwelling on the sense objects, developing attachment, gradually getting frustrated, becoming angrier, anger, forgetfulness, deep in the mode of ignorance, lost. Right?
Yeah,
not only that. So Krishna has is actually what he's desiring is to disentangle us from the material world. So when Krishna wants an offer, an offering from us, a sacrifice from us, then it's there's a purpose. Krishna's not just not like, well, I'm God, and today I want, you know, that you just sacrifice a leg, you know, just for a change, just for variety's sake. A leg today, please offer me a leg, you know, chop, you know, like, yeah, Krishna, here's my leg. That would make him, so it's Krishna's all acting out of love. So whenever he asks for a sacrifice, actually his love is in there. So it's all for your own good, you know. Like any question? Well, I never read that. Where did you read it? Just see. The Supreme Lord. I don't know either. This is the problem, you know. Like when you read these kind of books, these translations, we don't know if the translations are correct or what. And but even if Ram eats deers, it's very kind of him. He's kind upon the deers. If the Supreme Lord eats the deers, what more do you want? If he wants to eat you, let him eat us. But the source is not so reliable. So it would be interesting to do some more research and to go with some. Can give you the email address of someone who could give you the Sanskrit and a word for word of the relevant passages if you want. Another controversy. Okay. Good answer. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. Ki jai.